Hello, and thank you for tuning in to KSKA Anchorage. We're going to be taking a break from Line 1, Your Health Connection, this week for a special program on childhood trauma and its effects on us in adulthood. We'll be hearing from Dr. Christopher Blodgett of Washington State University on creating trauma-informed communities. This presentation was given at the Chamber Assembly Room at the LUSAC Library on November 3rd. We go now to Tamar Ben-Yosef of the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership for an introduction.
Hi, everyone. I'm really thrilled to see such a great turnout for today's event and the opportunity to partner with these great organizations for this occasion. The study of adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, in adults has helped change the conversation about risk and what children need in order to succeed. While ACEs are a tremendous call to action, trauma-informed care principles provide the roadmap for real change. Today, Dr. Blodgett will discuss how to provide a framework for integrating ACEs and trauma-informed practices in local community action. Dr. Blodgett is a Washington State University faculty member and a licensed clinical psychologist. He's been the principal investigator for more than 36 federal and national foundation grants addressing high-risk children and families. He and his team partner with communities and systems to adapt the science of resilience, brain development, and trauma treatment to better address trauma resulting from childhood adversity. Please welcome Dr. Chris Blodgett.
Well, hi, everybody. So I have to tell you, the big recurring debate I was having with myself was, should I wear a suit? Because culturally, Alaska's a little different. I live in Eastern Washington. I live in Spokane. And we're also a little more casual, so this is not typically how I dress. But hopefully, wanted to do honor, which is a lot of what it is that we talk about. And this kind of concept about how do you do honor to each other, I think, is really kind of at this whole heart of this conversation about what adversity does to us, how trauma shows itself in us, with this. So for 12 years, we've been doing this work in early learning settings and in K-12, and that's going to be a lot of my examples. We're in the process of doing this work into workforce development. So you think about the kids that come into welding classes or go to get their GEDs and are trying to kind of get themselves up and established so they can get into the workforce and be contributing citizens. We think this is another big place where this is a really relevant conversation. Because here's what we learn when we talk to employers about the issue of the workforce and the kind of challenges they're dealing with. It's not a skills issue. What it is that it's the soft skills issue. That's how employers talk about it, is that they've got folks that are coming in who don't know how to get along with folks. They have folks that are coming in to do the job, who get overwhelmed, who get so frustrated that they blow up in the workplace and they get fired because of their behavior. And this is kind of the example of the kind of cost that we start talking about when we start to use this idea of using this adversity and trauma lens to really start to think about how this takes the resources we've got as communities, both the human resources and how we use the material resources we have, how we make the kinds of investments, and we're on the wrong side of this conversation right now. What we do is we're investing in treatment and recovery, where we ought to be investing in trying to create the conditions where we never have to get there for the majority of people. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and I treat trauma. So I believe in the power of treatment. But I'm going to walk you through really quickly on some of the what the research tells us about the nature of what this problem is. But here's the major thing I really want to focus. People like me are only part of the solution. Because if it's one in three of us who have lived with these kinds of really challenging experiences, that's a pretty decent estimate, then we can't build treatment systems large enough. What we have to do is we have to figure out how do we have treatment become part of a process of solutions. But we got to get upstream, and it's got to be neighbor to neighbor. It's got to be employer to employee. It's got to be colleague to colleague about how it is that we're able to do this conversation with each other. So the conversation I think that we're really talking about when we get up outside of particular systems and we start to talk about this as a community issue is what we're talking about is how do we create the opportunities for people to participate and not have their histories be the thing that stopped them from being connected to others. That's really what, this is a conversation about community. This is a conversation about how we love and protect and care for each other with this. So schools, healthcare, youth development, employment success, these are some of the places that we can do this. For those of you who are parents or you want to be parents at some point, I would tell you this becomes a really personal conversation because these are the ideas about what do we do. I'm father to daughters. I have my first grandchild, and I find that these ideas are in the front of me every time I'm in this kind of an exchange because this is about who we are as human beings. So what I'm going to walk through in this presentation is I want to just kind of get us all grounded on this issue. What's the significance of ACEs? Why is this really kind of an important part of the conversation? I'm going to shift. I'm going to talk about the trauma that comes from ACEs. And what does that mean in terms of how we start to deal with this? And the reason why we link the discussion of trauma, and Tamar did this in the introduction, I just want to underscore it, is that we've learned in the last 30 years or so an awful lot about how to help people recover from trauma. We've got good knowledge and skills about these issues now. So the issue is, can we scale it up? Can we translate it so that it doesn't have to be through a therapist that you do this, but it can be through a teacher, it can be through an employer, it can be through people who have knowledge to be able to kind of use these ideas in a powerful kind of way. I'm going to talk about the fact that we need to think two levels when we start to deal with this. The first issue is how do we change? What's the individual things that we do that are different? How do we use this knowledge? But then whether it's in a school or a healthcare setting or in a neighborhood, we have to talk about the fact of what are we kind of collectively doing, that this has got to be about us as the systems and the communities we live in order to be able to have these conversations. Because when systems don't support individual change becomes really, really hard. You keep getting pushed back to the old ways of behaving. So what we've learned doing this work in schools for 12 years, if you can't bring the school culture and the climate and the policies along to support people behaving differently from these ideas, we can't get change to stick. And I think that it's a more general conversation about any organization that we talk about. And I'll talk a little bit about the specific intervention that we've developed that's really around working in early learning settings and in K-12. And it's not really to kind of push this particular program, but to give you kind of a little bit of a vision of what this can look like when you actually start to think about it and trying to scale up and get at these things. As I said, we've been doing this work for 12 years. We have been in 40 schools as of this year in terms of the work that we're doing. And what I'm trying to do is kind of carry forward the lessons that we've learned and what kids and people in those systems taught us about doing this work. And we're still feeling like we're learning a great deal. So let's talk a little bit about this whole issue of adverse childhood experiences. So the study started 25 years ago, still an active study that they're following. And here's what the bottom line was that they learned from the 17,000 people that they brought into the study. What they learned is when they said, can you tell us about things that happened to you when you were growing up? Did you experience child maltreatment? Did you have a parent who had a substance abuse problem? Did you have a parent that had mental health issues? Did a parent die? Did you end up having a family member go to prison? That these are the kinds of questions that they were asking, and your ACE score is how many times you said yes. So it's just you add those up. That becomes your ACE score. And what they found in this original study that's now been replicated on every continent in the world, it's been shown to be a cross-cultural issue that we end up dealing with, is that we found is that this is just tremendously common, that it's the minority of us who have not had this experience. So what we end up seeing is that more typically, this issue of having chaos in our families, early when we were growing up, this is a really, really common experience. Up to in the original study, what it was one out of four of basically a middle-class population of people and basically a white population of people. What they found, it was one in four of the folks said, I grew up where three or more of those things happened to me. So there are a couple of things, I don't want to kind of dwell a whole lot on the ACEs study, but there are a couple of things that are just really powerful, powerful ideas. One of them is, this is different from talking about things like depression or substance abuse, when it's about the tragedy that can happen for a group of people. What this is that if it's one in four or one in three of us who personally experienced this, this becomes really personal for us. This is part of our life story. But a second part of this is the issue that even if this is not your personal experience growing up, it is the experience of somebody you love. This touches every single one of us, and that's what makes this a different way to start to think about what does this mean for us personally, what does this mean for our families, for our churches, for our schools. It's a different conversation from other ways that we've tried to talk about why does life get really hard for some people. What they found, and this is what made, again, one of the critical kind of things that shifted, is what's been demonstrated is that if you grow up with four or more ACEs, that the chances that you're going to develop heart disease are three times more than they would be if you had no ACEs with this. The chances that you're going to end up having a suicide attempt goes up 12 times. The chance that you're going to be have a major episode of depression is four times more likely. And that's after we try to account for everything else that we know. So this issue of early childhood experiences creates risk that hits across health, across behavioral health, but it also does things like you're less likely to graduate from high school. You're less likely to be able to get a job and keep a job. And you're more likely to end up going into prison. So what we end up seeing is that this is not just a health issue, it's not just a mental health issue, it's an issue that touches every part of our community. And what this does is it steals our resources. It makes us invest where to the issue of the recovery from what could be prevented rather than being able to build roads, build bridges, invest in education, have the kind of healthcare system that we want. We spend billions and billions of dollars a year on the issue of repair and control rather than the issue of growth. And that, I just want to put that, that's the conversation. This is not a mental health conversation. This is a community well-being conversation. And that's the best lens. So why focus in on things like early learning systems, like THRED does here in Alaska, or K-12 education, or other kinds of places? It's because these are your community systems. These are the systems that define who you are as a community. So their success becomes the success of the communities that we're in. That's why working into these systems becomes really important. So this becomes a very personal conversation. I just want to kind of hold that out as that's one of the things that makes this different. And it changed the conversation about violence in our lives to and chaos in our lives to something that touches all of us that we can't step away from. We can choose to ignore it. But this is a bell you can't unring. So once you start to kind of think about these issues, you think about it personally through your own life or through the people that you love, you can't step back away from that knowledge. This is one of the things that is part of the challenge. This is why I spent much of the last 12 years building up way too many frequent flyer miles, because I come out to talk to folks like you about these kinds of issues, because I believe this is that important, that we've got to get the information out. We've got to start to figure out in local communities how we have this conversation. But here's the problem that we're dealing with right now. We don't have a good conversation with each other about when bad things happen in our communities. So I'm going to unpack this slide for you. This is a study that was done by a researcher named David Finkelhor. And he's a quite well-known criminal justice researcher. So the questions he was asking were big-ticket issues. It was about criminal justice kinds of problems. And the question that he asked in about 5,000 households across the U.S. is, he said, if you have a kid in your house between the ages of 5 and 18, did that child actually experience some kind of a violent victimization in the last 12 months? That was the question they asked. They had a long list of things. The thing really relevant to the list was that it was things that if police had known about it, it probably would have led to some sort of a police response. So it's that type of stuff that they were asking about. The first thing they did is they confirmed something that we've known for better part of two generations. We swim in violence as communities. Violence is just that routine. It's that common. It touches every single community. Some of us get to have more distance from it than others do. But this touches every community. And what we end up seeing when we start to look at this Is that we don't have a good conversation about that. We keep stepping away from the conversation, but we swim in violence. Because what they confirmed in the study is that it was 6 out of 10 of the kids in these 5,000 households had had at least one victimization in the past 12 months. Pause and think about that. 6 out of 10. And if you had one, the chances that you had other things happen to you accelerated, went up really, really fast with that. Why I think this is a really important study is not actually for confirming something we already knew, but they went on and they said, so if this happened to you and it happened to your child, did anybody in a position of responsibility know that it happened? And it was less than half of the families ended up saying that someone in a position of responsibility knew. They then went on and they asked, if you said yes, that somebody who was responsible knew, who was it? And that little narrow yellow slice there, that's primary health care. It was only 3% with this. So primary health care is no more prepared for this conversation than schools are, than child care providers are. This is that fresh a conversation for everybody. The 23% up in the upper left, that's law enforcement. Yeah, so the majority of things that happen are out of line of sight from police, you know, and that's not a knock on police. That's just the nature of what this is. This is a very private experience most of the time. The 74%, that's education. That's a teacher who knew. That's a cafeteria worker who knew. That's a bus driver who knew. And let me stress that. This is not all about the professionals. This is about the instructional aides and the cafeteria workers and the bus drivers, because we never know who's going to be the adult that matters to a kid and gets to hold this information. So we need to all get prepared from wherever it is that we sit with this. So one of the reasons we work in schools is that schools know about this, and schools have the relationship to start to think about how they can do. It's equally true in early learning that that's the case. So I want to walk you really quick through two studies that we've done. It's really to kind of highlight issues. So the ACEs research has mostly been about adults talking about what happened to them as children and now how they're doing and what their life has been like as adults. The thing that we've been missing until quite recently is actually being able to understand how is this playing out in the lives of kids. So again, it's not to knock the existing research about the adult experience of ACEs. It's to say we had a gap. We needed to understand how this was rolling out with kids. So this is a study we did in Spokane, where I live. This is 10 elementary schools. We randomly selected 2,100 kids. We never had contact with kids or the family. This was all the schools did the selection. We did it randomly. We just took rosters and identified half of the classes in these 10 schools, and that's who we ended up. We then went to the educators and we said, what do you factually know about the kinds of adversity kids have experienced? And so this was them reporting on the information they have. And the idea of this was that when we are in regular contact with each other, we get to hold a lot of information about each other. We learn things, and we hold that knowledge. So what we did is we took the original ACEs questionnaire, and we changed it a little bit so that we didn't walk into safety issues about, you know, somebody saying, yes, this was a kid who had a child maltreatment experience, and CPS didn't know it, because we're what are called mandated reporters. And if we learn about child abuse, we're required by law to call Child Protective Services. And it's not a judgment call for us. If we suspect, we have to call. That's what the law says. So we wanted to be very careful about not getting into those kinds of problems. When we asked those questions, about half the 2,100 kids, the educators said, you know, we don't have any evidence that these kids actually have had any of the experiences. But half of the kids, they knew that they had at least one. And 1 out of 5 of the kids in my community, across these 10 schools, kids that had 2 or more that were known. And these are, again, child abuse, it's child neglect, it's mental health problems, substance abuse problems, death of a parent, incarceration of a parent, homelessness, things like that. That's the kinds of questions that we were asking. And what we did is we then brought that into an analysis where we tried to control for everything that we could think of. The gender of the child, how old was the child, what school did they go to, race and ethnicity. We brought all that in and tried to kind of knock that out so we didn't have to have that be noise in looking at this. And here's what we learned, that understanding the ACEs history of the child was the single most powerful predictor we had for whether they were succeeding in school, knowing their ACEs history through the lens of what the educators knew. So what this is, what I've got up on the screen, is what's called an odds table. So if you go to the casinos, you think you understand odds. I'm going to argue you actually probably don't. The issue here is the way you read an odds table, you start at the bottom and you compare it to the group of kids where there were no known ACEs, and you set that value equal to 1. And then you come up, and let's take the academic failure line here. So with 1 known ACE, kids were 1.5 times already in elementary school to be failing. With 2 ACEs, they were 2.5 times more likely, and with 3 ACEs, they were 3 times more likely to be academically failing. Read across the top, and that's the 1 in 10 kids who had 3 or more ACEs when we went through this. For severe attendance problems that stopped them from being able to be able to learn and profit from being in school, so this was chronic absenteeism, coming to school late, leaving early, missing whole days with this. With the kids that had 3 or more ACEs, they were 5 times more likely to have that chronic absence problem. And this is after we controlled for poverty, and I'll come back on that point in a second. Race didn't matter. Ethnicity didn't matter. These dropped out. These were not issues. We found that little boys are a lot more vulnerable than little girls, and if you hang out with little boys, that's not a surprise to anybody, because little boys struggle more than little girls do often around a bunch of things. Severe behavior problems that interfered with academic success in the 1 in 10 kids with 3 or more ACEs, 6 times more likely these were kids that had chronic behavior problems. And then on poor reported health, and the way we defined that was this is a kid who has a pattern that on average they are saying at least 2 times a month, I'm too sick to continue in school. So that we made it a very concrete kind of an example for what we were dealing. They were 4 times more likely to be involved in that kind of a behavior. So what we end up, really, we believe, being able to argue is that we can show that understanding the ACEs history directly impacts the success of schools to be able to prepare kids to be contributors in the economy, to be good citizens, to be able to move forward. And I just want to hit a couple of things here. When kids are failing in elementary school, we are very challenged to change that with our current practices. And indeed, what the research says is that by grade 4, if you've been identified as a kid as a school behavior problem, and you are academically failing, you are many, many times less likely to graduate from high school. So graduating from high school is still the best single marker of your ability to make a living wage and be able to be a contributing citizen, but it's also critically one of the most important predictors we have of your lifetime health. So folks that don't graduate from high school as a group are much more likely to have chronic health problems. So this issue of educational success becomes the door through which many, many people walk to come to a better life, to be able to move forward. And that's why this ACEs conversation becomes really important. This is a major driver for why it is that we lose people in the education profession, that they come in and then they leave. And here's what the research tells us. Depending on the study that you look at, between 1/3 and 1/2 of teachers who start this year as educators are going to be out of the profession 5 years from now. That's the kind of churn that we see in education. We lose between 1/3 and 1/2 of each year's new teachers coming in. They leave the profession. Now, they leave for a bunch of reasons, but one of the identified major reasons is this issue of they will report and say, I was not prepared in my education to know how to be able to manage the kinds of behaviors that kids bring into school. And I don't know how to handle this, and it's overwhelming me, and it's making me feel so discouraged in my job that I'm going to go look for a different job. Now, why as citizens should you matter about that? If you're rolling that number of people out of the profession, it is taking dollars out of your pocket because it is costly to go and rehire. It is costly to bring in and retrain, that this becomes a practical economic issue that hits every community in the United States.
This is 91.1 FM, Alaska Public Media. You are listening to a program about creating trauma-informed communities. Our speaker today is Dr. Christopher Blodgett of Washington State University. He's discussing data he has gathered from the study of adverse childhood experiences, also known as the ACEs study. We'll learn more about that study and how it can assist caregivers of children as we continue with the program.
The next study that we did, we just did in a Head Start program in Spokane, where I live. So this is a pretty big urban Head Start program. And the work we did over about 6 years was we were working to help the Head Start program become a trauma-informed system. So it's not just how services were being provided, but that these ideas started to come into everything that they did, how they thought about classroom management, how they talked to parents, how they were able to kind of prioritize the things that they were doing to educate kids. But part of what we needed to do for this particular funding was we needed to actually do support interventions for families that had experienced significant ACEs and resulting trauma. So we introduced an ACEs questionnaire, a screener, into how Head Start did its work. So over about a four-year period, we've ended up having conversations that Head Start staff did with Head Start caregivers, mostly parents, but aunts and uncles and grandparents who were the caregiver for the child. And here were the questions that we asked. The first question was to the adult was, when you were growing up, how many of these things happened to you? So we asked about their own ACE history. And then when they were done talking about their own experience, we asked them to talk about the ACE experience of their 3 or 4 year olds. So keep the age in mind here. These are 3 and 4 year old little kids. That's what Head Start does as its service. So we've got parent and child paired ACE scores on about 1,600 families. I want to hit one thing about what we think is necessary about how did we do this work. You never force this conversation on somebody. You make this voluntary. You invite them into the conversation. And if you are respectful and you explain to them what you're doing and why their story is important, people are very generous. So in this Head Start program, we had 8 out of 10 of the parents agree to share their story with this. And so the important thing I want to really stress there is that if you start to use these ideas about how to move forward, you never force this on folks. You invite them. You make this a conversation, a connection between you, and you respect people's right to say no, to not share what they don't want to share. So we had a couple of really sobering things that came out of this. The first one is how common ACEs were in my community and the families that Head Start served, because it was 1 out of every 2 parents in Head Start said that they experienced 4 or more ACEs when they were growing up. 1 out of every 2. And when they were talking about their own children, 3 and 4 year olds, they said that 1 out of every 4 children in Head Start had experienced 4 or more ACEs by the time that they were 4 years old. When I ran the analysis on this, again, I'm a university researcher. That's a big part of who I am in terms of dealing with this. I have to tell you, my heart was in my shoes. This is very, very personal. This is because I know what the cost means when you start to talk about this. Okay, so that's part of my presentation where I just depress the bejesus out of you. And now I'm going to shift and I want to start talking about why it is that we should be hopeful. Why it is that we can do things with this. What we've done, along with many other people, is what we've said, let's honor this issue about what we know about ACEs, because it tells us the scope of the problem. It tells us none of us get to be bystanders. Every one of us is touched by this in some fashion or another. But it doesn't tell us what to do, except don't have these problems. And that doesn't, frankly, feel real productive as a conversation. So what we can do is we can go to what developed, this comes out of actually mental health treatment. And over the last 30 years, we have learned in mental health a great deal about how people can be treated and recover from trauma. The origins of this actually are around combat recovery. It's around post-traumatic stress disorder. So part of the history about how this developed around kids was that in the early 1990s, when the American Psychiatric Association went to kind of recertify that post-traumatic stress disorder was a legitimate diagnosis, they at that point had about 15 years of research experience with doing treatment for PTSD that was good treatment. But what they were finding is about a quarter of the folks that were going into these well-designed treatment systems for PTSD weren't getting better. So they started saying, well, why is it when this treatment works for so many that it doesn't work for some? And they dug into that as a question. And what they came up with is that the common characteristic of the folks that could not benefit from the treatment that was being offered at the time was that they had significant histories of childhood adversity. That was something they brought into the service with them as they went into combat, that it created the vulnerability, and the issue was this longer-term developmental problem that just got gasoline on the fire when they got into combat situations in dealing with this. So that started this whole line of, let's start to try to understand, what does this mean for how trauma can be a problem in childhood, and it had not actually been a major focus of work prior to that. So came a major focus. Now nearly 30 years later, we have more than 20 established treatment practices for working with trauma that comes from ACEs in kids. It's a very mainstream part of mental health treatment. And what we propose is that we can take those lessons that have been tested out in mental health and we can translate them for people who don't do treatment, but are child care providers, our K-12 educators, our primary health nurses, that we can use these ideas to help actually translate. And I want to really stress this. This is the language that we use when we walk into schools and we talk to teachers about this. We don't want teachers to be therapists. What we think is that these ideas can help folks be better teachers because you understand many of the kids that you're working with a better set of tools. So we do translation of the best practice recommendations for mental health for the treatment of trauma to fit into different kinds of settings to apply these ideas. And that's what the rest of my presentation is kind of walking you through that, talking to you about what we've learned about being able to do this work well. So complex trauma is ACEs. So one of the characteristics of complex trauma is this idea that multiple bad things happen to you very early in life. So we use the term complex trauma to separate this from how we talk about trauma otherwise. So let me tell you something that I know about you without ever having met you. The majority of you in the room, might not be everybody, it's going to be close to everybody, you're a trauma survivor. I know that because I know that trauma is that common and as a part of being a human being. Now, I'm not talking about ACEs. I'm talking about things like having a life-threatening illness, being in an accident where you nearly died, being a victim of crime where you were at risk. Having somebody who is near and dear to you die. So those would be the kinds of traumas that I'm talking about. And I want to just pause on this, talk about this a little bit, to separate what we mean by complex trauma. When trauma happens, for the vast majority of us, we're changed by it, but we're not broken by it. What happens is as we come from the loss, we're changed. But we grow and we come back to life and we do the things that we need to do. And what we know about in adults in North America, where this has been studied, is that the average number of life-changing traumatic experiences, the average number in adults in North America is 4 experiences with that. So part of that, why that can be really helpful, is that your own experience, even if you don't come from ACEs, and have that kind of background, coming from trauma and understanding what that journey was for you can help make this very personal. It can help you understand the issues that we're dealing with. Complex trauma is different. Complex trauma is this issue of being exposed to multiple simultaneous problems very early in your life that create chaos and stop you from being able to grow the way you need to grow, as God intended you to be able to. That's the difference. This is the issue of what happens early in life. So again, just to stress that point, we know that when ACEs occur in the lives of children, overwhelmingly they occur, they get established, and they continue before the age of five. So this becomes really important for a couple of things about how we try to understand and why this is a different conversation. And my focus is on childhood, but I will tell you, unaddressed, these problems continue on into adulthood, and they just become the baggage you carry with you if you haven't been able to get the healing done to get past it. So when this gets established in this kind of way, here's the two things that I really would highlight that make this a different conversation. The first one is that if you're 3 or 2 years old and your dad is drugging and your mom is so depressed you can't get out of bed and your uncle went to jail and your family is having to deal with that, at 2 or 3 years old, you can't escape it. You can't walk away. You can't get in your car and drive to go see a friend. What you do is you survive. You can't escape. You're there. The second part of this is if you're 2 or 3 years old and this is happening, you don't have language to make sense out of what happens. Here's what happens for us as adults when tragedy happens to us. We're able finally to make a story that makes sense about what happens. And that's part of healing from trauma, is being able to have a story that puts it in place and helps us understand why this happened. And I talk about this fairly routinely, sometimes with a fair amount of emotion, I have to admit. I come from a family of 7 kids, and my youngest brother committed suicide. And he committed suicide with a shotgun. And I was part of cleaning up afterwards. When I got the call that my brother had died, I can tell you, this was 20 years ago now. I was sitting on a couch, and the experience I had was that I was one person the minute before the phone rang, and I was a different person after that. Trauma changed me. And I'll tell you how it changed me. I have 2 daughters, and to this day, both my daughters are grown. I'm terrified for my daughters because the world is unsafe and unpredictable. So one of the ways that trauma changed me in this situation is it took away a certain sense of that my kids were safe. That was the place. We get changed. But that's us as adults making sense. So that experience, where it's still a very raw and very personal one for me, is not one that owns me. It's not one that stops me from who I am and what I'm trying to do with my life. It actually is part of what drives me, is to the work I do. And I think that you all probably have some variation of a story like that that you can pull to. But we use language to make sense. We lose our ability to make choices to get better. And kids don't have that. So what happens is that this gets hardwired into our biology when it's complex trauma, because we can't have the other options. We survive, and the stress that comes with this ends up changing who we are. So the way we talk about this, stress itself is not the problem. The term that's used is called toxic stress. And toxic stress is when you can't escape it. It's continuing over long periods of time. One of its qualities is that it's persisting, but it's unpredictable. So a story that I tell is from one of the people that I work with in Spokane, and she was working with a family that lived in a rural part of the county. They lived up a long gravel road, and as their dad would come home, the 5 and 8 year old kids in the house would sit in the living room each night, and they were waiting for their dad to come home. And here's what they were waiting for. They were waiting to hear how hard the gravel was hitting the underside of his truck, because when it was loud enough, what they did is they went out the window into the woods until their mom came and told them it was safe to come back into the house. Now, they loved their dad, and their dad most of the time was able to be there, but he was also real unpredictable, and often he was unsafe. So these are kids who every night had to be on guard. Every night they had to wonder which of my dads is coming home. And when that was the case, here's what trauma does. Trauma from ACEs in kids is it steals our basic sense of safety. And the hunt to get safe becomes one of the major things that drives them from that point forward, because it's that basic a human need. So that's one of the big ticket issues about what makes this a different conversation. It also means that we can end up doing things about this. What we end up seeing is that one of the problems that we have when we talk about this is mostly when we're talking about adverse childhood experiences, we're talking about things that happen inside families. So the tendency when we see kids who are hurting and we are worried about what the parents are doing is we're pretty inclined to get angry at the parent and to blame the parent. And it's a natural human reaction. It's also an absolute dead end, because getting angry doesn't give us choices. It doesn't allow us to come back. And here's what we know. Most of the parents who have kids who are struggling with multiple kinds of adverse childhood experiences themselves were kids. That's what we found in the Head Start study, is that overwhelmingly the kids with the highest ACEs were with parents who were saying they had high ACEs. So this is an intergenerational problem that ends up working with this. So part of what we think we really have to do is just be very honest about avoiding this issue of parent blaming. It doesn't help. It doesn't give us any tools. And kids go home, or they stay home. So that what we've got to figure out is how to have a different conversation with parents, even when families are in tough spots. This just has to be a different way that we talk about this. I'm going to do one kind of last comment about the issue of how do we think about ACEs. The issues of racism, the issues of inequity, are powerful things that need to be honored and dealt with in their own right. They shouldn't be lumped in under this concept of ACEs. They all sit kind of together, and when they pile up, if you're poor and you're facing racism and you have ACEs, it's this piling on of these kinds of issues that become very powerful, but we should not kind of mash them all together and treat them as the same thing. They're distinct, important things in their own rights that we have to figure out how we're going to deal better with this. So ACEs was one plank for dealing with this. Issue of understanding trauma and what complex trauma is becomes a second tool to start to get the idea together. And let me tell you, the least interesting thing I can know about you as a person is your sad story. What I want to know is, what did you do about your sad story? What I want to know is, what do you grow and what do you love and how do you contribute? Because that's what makes you a human being. It's about, we got to go to growth. We can't get stuck where we're admiring the tragedy and that we stayed there. So we think that the other place you need to go is to use this idea of resilience. So looking over at Trevor and the work that's being done here in Alaska, where a lot of this is being organized around really thinking about how do we build resilience. Let me give you the definition on resilience. Resilience is the ability to grow and prosper and contribute despite the fact that you experienced adversity. So you can't get resilient if you haven't been tested, if you've not been challenged and lost and had to pick yourself up and try again. You can't be resilient unless you've faced adversity. So we've got to be challenged in order to grow. It becomes a major part of what we need to do. So one of the challenges around talking about resilience, sometimes when people talk about this, they say, you know, this is really a vague set of ideas, and it's hard to kind of get to action about what you're dealing with. And I would want to push back against that. I don't think that's true. So I'm going to suggest to you there are three things that we can translate into really practical action to try to deal with this. And here's the first one. We got to address the issue of how people stop believing in themselves. That's the first thing. We got to give people hope. And then we got to give them a belief that if they try, they have a better than decent chance of succeeding. And this gets stolen when you come from adversity and the resulting trauma. So the majority of schools that we've worked with are predominant minority student populations. That's been our experience in the schools we've been working in. And here's what one of the things, and again, I just want to acknowledge, I'm a white man speaking to these issues, and I try to do this with as much humility as I can with this, but if I can't be part of the conversation, we're going to have a really tough time trying to figure this out. We got to figure out how, not that I carry the story forward, but that I can be a witness with people about how we deal with these things. So here's one of the things that we've learned in schools with this, that when you talk to, the research has not been done in Native Alaskan or American Indian communities that I know of. I've not seen this. So this has mostly come out of Latino and African American communities where they've ended up asking this. When they talk to African American and Latino kids who are in particularly high school, and they say, "Do you believe in the power of education? Do you believe that education would be part of what's going to carry you forward?" They go, "Oh no, I absolutely believe education's path forward to getting to a better life." And then they pause, and then they say, "Often, but I don't believe that's true for me." So they can tell you that education is the tool to get ahead, but they think that it's disconnected from their own experience. They don't believe this is true for who they are. That's the loss of hope. That's the disconnection. And if we can't get over that gap, we lose kids. We lose the human capital about how we get better as communities. So we've got to challenge belief, and we got to give kids opportunity to earn the right to hope, that that becomes the tool. The second issue is we got to think about this as really practical skills. So the three big issues that come out of the resilience literature about thinking about this is they say there are really three things that we should focus on. The first is kids and adults have to learn how to be able to productively regulate their own emotional state. Can't get overwhelmed by anger, can't get overwhelmed by anxiety, can't get overwhelmed by despair. They got to learn how to be able to control this. They have to regulate the emotional experience. So that's a skill set that we get taught. If we're lucky, we get taught by our parents, and we get taught in schools, and it becomes part of who we are. Some kids lost the lesson, and it's got to come back, and we got to teach it intentionally. The second issue is that if you don't know how to get along with people, you're in a lot of trouble. So we got to teach the ability to be able to be with each other, to be able to listen, to be able to put our needs to the side so that we can understand the needs of the person next to us. That these are kind of core relationship skills. So we got to teach to it if it hasn't been something that's been able to be given naturally to children. And then the third one, it's the technical language that gets used, it's executive function. Well, here's what executive function, if that's not a familiar term to you, it's the ability to problem solve. It's the ability to have a moral decision. It's the ability to access your memory and remember the things that can help you solve the problem in front of you right now. That's what we mean by executive function. Here's where executive function lives. It lives right behind your frontal, your forehead. It's in what's called the prefrontal cortex. So it's that part of the brain is where this happens. And it's our ability to use language to do problem solving, make moral choices. So in education, and part about the misconnection for schools and why this is an issue is where education has doubled down, is trying to build up executive function to really have that. You can't argue that that's a bad decision, but here's what we know about brain development, is that if you get, you're overwhelmed 10, 15, 20 times a day by your sense of fear, you're not going to be able to ever get to the part of your brain that can do problem solving. If you're so isolated and so lonely that you can't be able to succeed in class, you're never going to be able to get successful most of the time in the lessons you need to learn. We got to go to foundation to build to the skills. We got to build relationships to emotional regulation to get to the ability for people to be able to learn more effectively. That is a challenge in education because that is a reset in some important ways about where do we prioritize, what do we do in classrooms, how do we end up thinking about these issues. But what I just did is I laid out to you what we know about how brains operate, where the science is catching up on these kinds of issues. The last thing, when we start talking about resilience, is we start talking about we can do things, particularly for kids, that make the environment they're in kinder, more supportive, and more powerful resources for them. So one of the issues is that it's social support. So we work in schools. Every time I walk in to do a classroom observation, here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the kid who is just kind of circling by him or herself, not connected to any other kid, that's isolated. Because being isolated from other people hurts. It's painful. And if you cannot be connected to other people, you lose one of the most critical kinds of support for being able to tolerate change, work hard on the things that you need to do. So we need to build social support. We need to see it as an absolute direct thing to do. Now, this is as true for you as a parent as it is if you were a third grade teacher or you were working in a child care center. These questions, there is a shipbuilding yard in Ketchikan, Alaska. The name of it is?
Vigor.
Thank you. That was purposely set up that way, Trev. Vigor Shipbuilding Yards, which I would love to get down and visit, says that their primary mission, I'm paraphrasing because I haven't talked to them, but they say their mission as an organization is to love each other. Holy cow. This is a shipbuilding company. And they've said that they think they can take these ideas and they can be a better company because they do these things. So they don't... one of the stories that I got told that really stayed with me is they had... a guy had a lot of trouble getting along with other people, might have had some autism kind of things going on with him, was really good at organization, and rather than firing him for the problems that he had getting along with other people, they put him on inventory control. They went to his strengths. They did it on purpose because they didn't want to lose him, because they had a value. That's one of the most lovely examples of how this doesn't have to be about professionals like me bringing this conversation forward. It's us owning it. It's us figuring out how do we use it to be the kind of communities we want to be. So, environment matters. The forgiving and repairable settings, we have to allow people to make a mistake and not get blown up by their mistakes. They have to be able to have a chance to recover, repair, and contribute. This is a big issue in schools because we are still deeply committed in many, many communities to the issue of zero tolerance of problems, of punitive discipline as a way that we respond to rule violation. And once you screw up in many settings, you don't have an easy path to come back and be part of the community again. And we have to solve that. We have to make that be a different conversation. Then the last one is about just there are some really practical, simple things about social and basic resources. So here's one of the really practical pieces of advice we give to teachers all the time. Keep granola bars in your desk because hangry is a real thing. And if you feed a kid, you can shortcut a whole bunch of problems. So this is not about big, abstract, complex ideas. This is about having a few really particular things that you go for, and you just keep going for it. You just keep working the problems as you deal with this. So third plank about how we deal with this is let's get to building the strength in the kids and the people that we live with, and we think about this through this resilience lens. So here's what we know about how trauma from ACEs ends up impacting, and it's a long list. I'm not going to read it to you. I want to highlight a couple of things, though. Talked about this issue that one of the things that's a casualty of if you come out of trauma from ACEs, you have a lot of trouble being able to navigate relationships and to control your own emotions so that you can navigate. Those are big-ticket issues. It becomes really critical around this idea of threat arousal regulation. So let me break that down a little bit. Our genetic history is based on the issue of we survived when animals wanted to eat us. So that what we have in our genetics is powerful built-in tools about constantly measuring our environment about, are we safe? And it's actually organized by a particular part of the brain that's called the amygdala. And what the amygdala does, and it's not under conscious control, it's an automatic reaction. The amygdala, tens of thousands of times per minute, is asking this question: am I safe, am I not? Safe, not safe, safe, not safe. It's constant. You're doing it right now, I'm doing it right now. That we are constantly monitoring. It is part of our genetic heritage that we do this. What happens with trauma is that trauma resets the sensitivity of when danger is present. And the way it plays out often in kids is any change is a potential threat. So that this becomes hugely disruptive and really confusing to us about, why did you blow up? Because we stopped doing math. And it's because things like transitions from one activity to another is a change that can trigger that sense of being unsafe. So trauma steals safety, and it resets us in terms of our sensitivity. Now, the good news is we can retrain from that. We can be different if we work at this. Last thing on this slide I want to highlight, the term is a mental health term. It's dissociation. Dissociation describes when, in order to survive, because my emotions overwhelm me, is I'm going to cut myself off from my own emotions. So sometimes when people talk about being dissociated, they say, my experience of the world is like I'm watching television. It's not that I'm part of it, it's that I'm watching it. I just feel that literally disconnected with this. And what that is a survival strategy. It's when emotions are so intolerable and they overwhelm you, cutting yourself off. Well, how does that translate in early learning and K-12 situations? These are the kids that don't challenge you. These are the kids who quietly fail at the back of the classroom. They fade into the wallpaper. And we have to be equally concerned about not just the high flyers, kids who challenge and annoy us, as much as the kids who simply are being left as lost souls, not being able to move forward. So we got to be able to have a bigger way that we think about the kinds of problems that we're dealing with. My basic point to you so far in this is that when we start talking about trauma, this is biology that we're talking about, and we're talking about trying to reset it. So I want to highlight four kind of rules that are powerful tools to be able to think about. Here's the first one. As human beings, we cannot grow and organize ourselves except by being in relationship with each other. Our brains depend on the connection and reactions we get from the people around us. That's how we organize our brains. So anything that interrupts relationship challenges brain development. Second is that we mostly have been taught to think of ourselves as thinking human beings, that this is the definitional issue. The reality about how brains operate is thinking is the last thing we do. The first thing we do is we have reflexive reactions because that's what we needed to survive. The second thing we do is primarily we're emotional beings, and we feel and then we think. And understanding that is the basic difference, really shifts how you try to do problem solving and how you think about what you need to do if you're at the head of a classroom of 30 kids trying to figure out how you're going to teach math. You got to get that under control about the emotional reaction so that they can access their head. And I'm going to come back and I'm going to hit that on a couple of different themes. Last two are that what you get exposed to shapes your brain. And that's a little scary because if you've been shaped in your brain by the fact the world is a scary, unpredictable place and survival is the first thing I've got to be prioritizing, and that's what trauma does to you, that's going to change your brain. So what we know, the biology of this, we can demonstrate through CAT scans, through MRIs, that trauma changes both the structure and function of brains in many people. It shifts us. The good news, and that's the last point on this slide, is we keep changing our brains until the moment we die. So this is a hopeful conversation. We are not doomed. I will tell you, it is a lot easier to do that with a 3-year-old than it is to do it with a 53-year-old. But even there, 53-year-olds can change. That we have the possibility, and that is a hopeful statement for who we are as human beings. as important as it is to recognize the power of ACEs and the result of trauma, let's not get stuck in admiring the problem. Let's understand that and focus this. But we're in the growth business. We're in the contribution business as human beings. That's what drives us. Let's have our focus be about what we do to recover and to be caring, loving, contributing people. That means that we gotta be on about a different agenda than just stopping pain. Stopping pain is a really pretty good goal, but it's not a sufficient goal. It's not the place where we should end the work that we end up doing. I think that the critical difference in this conversation using ACEs as a lens is that none of us get to, I've used the language before, none of us get to be on the sidelines with this. We can decide that we don't think it's a big enough problem, but there are very few of us who get to go away untouched by this. So this makes it a different conversation. Now, it may be more concentrated in particular communities, but this is a place, one issue is that if we use the ACEs lens, even though that may not be the issue where my kids go to school, I have a big stake in the fact that if there are other schools in my school district that are failing because of these issues, then that's my community, that this is the issue, and it's not the first person to the lifeboats, you know, as the solution for dealing with this. So I would make the argument that investing where the need is greatest is a sensible thing to do, but that the need is great many, many places. So that I think that we need a less of a focus on concentrated solutions and more of an issue of a mixed method where we go for the broadest ready response because of the scope of the problem, so many different places. And then we then look about the issue of how do we concentrate resources for the most vulnerable people with that. You know, this issue of ACEs in disenfranchised communities, in racially diverse communities, is a big part of this kind of conversation that we have to have, and the need is that great. I tend to get kind of worried that people in indigenous communities and in African American and Latino communities do not need me coming in and doing a definition of their problems. What they need me to do is to be a partner in terms of dealing with this, because again, come back to an earlier part of the conversation, every one of these communities also have unique strengths that become part of the balancing conversation for how do we deal with this. So I think that part of what makes ACEs different is that this is a broader spectrum set of solutions than thinking about a more targeted approach. And I think the issue is we need to think about how we lift all boats in this conversation. At least that's my personal opinion about dealing with this. So I've got about 15 minutes left with you today to wrap this up. I'll hang out if there are questions that we can end up having with this. But I want to hit two things again about practically what do we know about trauma and what do we start to dealing with this. So the way I like to talk about this is that if we start to use these ideas, we need to start thinking about ourselves as kind of trauma detectives. It's how do we start to decode the behavior that we're seeing? And there are two big threads that come out from what we know about this work. The first one is what I've said several times. What trauma does from ACEs is it steals an essential sense of safety. And safety then becomes this huge driver that helps to explain why people do things that otherwise can really mystify us, confuse us very, very deeply. And through the safety lens, what we can focus on is understanding what triggers it and how do we manage triggers. So an example of that in schools is we work a lot on the issue of transitions. How do you go from one activity to the next so that you do it with intention and sense? And I'll just give you a simple example of that. Working in a school where what they ended up doing is they're very early in this first year doing this, and what they ended up saying when we started talking about this issue that transitions translate to a lack of safety if you have this trauma history, they said, we've got a problem with how we manage recess. And it's their language, not mine, but what they ended up saying is that basically we put kids out at recess and it's a free-for-all. And we get these kids tearing around, getting really, really ramped up, and then we expect them to line up quietly, go back into classroom, and immediately walk into the next instructional lesson and succeed. And they went two places about taking this idea, and they said, we need to let them play, but we need to let the play be safer and more organized and more controlled. out there. So they started talking about how do we do kickball, things that, were things that we experienced when we were, a lot of us were growing up. The second thing they said is we better figure out a transition activity so that kids can calm themselves back down so that when they go back into the classroom, they're more ready to learn. Now, that's going to be true for all kids, but it's particularly true for thinking about the kids in any situation, regardless of the percentage. For the kids who have experienced trauma, those are the kids who get ramped up and can't ramp themselves back down, and they need structural help to be able to do that. So it's a practical issue about using this issue of how safety gets triggered because change triggers a sense of danger with that. The second biggest issue that we have focused on in terms of doing this work is opening the conversation about discipline versus accountability. So we've had a two-generation experiment with zero tolerance, with punitive disciplinary practices. We are not done moving through that conversation, but there is a big national conversation going right now about did that work out for us. And there's a general sense, even though we haven't changed practice, is that this didn't work very well. And in point of fact, what it did is it drove a lot of kids out of school. And the phrase that gets used with this, particularly for brown and black students, is the school-to-prison pipeline. That what we did is we actually created situations by thinking that we had to have such a harsh response to rule violation and through a safety lens, that what we did is we drove these kids out for major support, and that they became, this is established in research, they became much more likely to enter the juvenile justice system and to move into the adult criminal justice system. So we're going through a process more generally, this is not particularly a trauma conversation, about as an education policy, did that work? What we would argue is that this is not a free-for-all conversation. What it is a shift to accountability. So in this triggering issue, that's why I'm bringing this up here, is you cannot use punitive punishment as a control strategy unless you're using shame as part of what you do. And shame for people who come from trauma is an inherently triggering experience. It makes them deeply unsafe, and they then lose control, and they're more likely to act out and continue the cycle of escalating up associated with this. Our issue is that you can have clear, coherent rules that help kids understand how to be with each other and to contribute without ever having to raise your voice or to shame or punish somebody. And it's by having clear consequences that follow. It's how many of us have tried to parent. My experience as a parent is one of the early lessons I had is I couldn't parent well if I was angry. That the very first thing I had to do is I had to go get myself under control. Because my job when I was disciplining my children was that I was to teach my children. The issue wasn't to walk away from the issue. The issue was what it was that I was going to help them learn. And I didn't want them to learn that to be afraid of me. And the teachers don't want that to be the lesson that gets learned. So we need accountability because it's how it is that kids can test limits and learn and take lessons forward from mistakes that they make. So we can't walk away from high standards and high accountability. We have to separate it from making people feel bad about themselves and ashamed of themselves with that. And this, in a trauma lens, becomes a really major issue. I've watched kids ramp all the way up into full physical confrontations because shame was the thing that was driving them in the midst of this. So this issue about thinking about how we manage triggers through the safety lens becomes one of the major practical threads that we can teach to. We can build skills around how do you understand and deal with that. And again, this is more general than schools. It applies across many different organizations. The second one is the issue of, and I'm going to read the top line to you because it's really what the pivot is. In the absence of sensitive and consistent responses from caregivers, a child will develop their own strategies to get their needs met. So here's why this is such an important concept. What we're dealing with mostly when we deal with trauma and the way the trauma shows itself is an issue of how children had learned to be able to survive and get their needs met. And the challenge is what worked for them isn't working anymore. It's a bad fit to the situation that they're in. Why is that so important? We want to pull the trigger on defining somebody as mentally ill when they violate on rules or they act in ways that make us uncomfortable. And from this lens, most of the time, the reset is that the issues we're dealing with is that they learned a way to survive and get their needs met that now is a disconnect, and this is an education issue. This is an issue of how do you help them give up on what's an ineffective strategy to move forward with a more productive way of being able to deal with these issues. So there are three, around this needs fulfillment issue, there are three big kind of tracks that you can work with, and two of them are the big dominant issues. It's relationship, relationship, relationship. One of the things that we see as one of the major drivers for problems in schools between kids and teachers is kids desperately want the time and attention of the adult. And they are trying to get that need met, and they act out, and they disrupt. And if you challenge the behavior without addressing the need, you get in a vicious cycle. You can't get yourself out of this as an issue. So by being able to use these ideas to say, what is the need that's being sought? And how do I meet that in a way that is positive and respectful, gets you out of the struggle for control that ends up happening between child and teachers on a very regular basis. Second one is the issue of kids need to feel that they can master things, that they have success. All of us need that. So that a lot of the ways that kids get challenged, that will challenge us as adults, is that what they're doing is they're trying to have the experience that they have control, that they were successful, that they could deal with these things. And we can end up stopping the fight and focusing on, okay, how can I help you have that experience in a way where you don't have to blow up my class? So that if you think about this as a decoding process, that these are not choices people are making. These are things that get driven from early lessons. That if we think through the safety or needs fulfillment lens, we start to have tools to decode behavior to start to figure out what is the major thing that we're ending up dealing with. Kind of for sense of time, I just want to come back on this issue that if you're under stress and you flipped your lid, you cannot learn. Your brain is not ready. The parts of your brain that are involved with new learning are offline. So what we need to do in any situation is help people get to a point of calmness, of being able to be not having to struggle so much with the immediate kinds of stress and struggle and anxiety that they're working with, because this is what leads to people being able to fully integrate brain function. So what we talk about that is it's the ability to help people self-regulate. So that a way to think about this is that is a set of skills that we have to teach to as we start to deal with this. But the critical thing that we've learned about teaching self-regulation is that the strongest way that we do this is that we co-regulate with the child or with the adult that we're working with. So how I choose to respond to you gives you choices for how you respond to me. If I am calm, you will mirror and model with me. So that this issue of how we use ourselves as instruments to help others becomes one of the most powerful tools, actually, that we can end up bringing to bear on this. So there are some direct technique teaching that you can end up doing with this. But this issue of how we stay connected and how we use ourselves, and I'll just give you a very simple, it's a powerful example. This was in a school in California that we're working with, and one of my colleagues was doing the work in the building. And what this was a kid that was a fourth grader who was a runner. So when he would get distressed, he would just book. And he would be out of the classroom, down the hall, out onto the playground. It's a very common experience in schools. You get kids who are runners. So this was a kid who was so agitated at this point that when they got him into the vice principal's office, he was sitting on an exercise ball and his body was going like this. Just that fast. What my colleague did, because this kid was so out of control at that point, couldn't use language, wasn't able to hear or respond to what was said, what my colleague did was she started moving with him. So he was going like this, she was coming back. And what she did is she started slowing down. And as she began to slow down, he slowed down. And as he was able to calm himself, she could start talking to him. And it's one of the kind of simplest, most powerful examples, this idea of co-regulation. A lot of it we can do with tone of voice, with language. What we've learned with this is we can expose people to this knowledge, but the key issue in any situation, if we're going to start to use these ideas, is being exposed to new knowledge by itself is not enough. The way that we learn and we change is we get exposed to new knowledge, then we have an opportunity to practice differently, and then we have a chance to talk about and reflect on how we were different so that we can kind of cement what we learned with this. So the reason we do a coaching model over 3 years in schools is to help people kind of progressively go from, I have an understanding of what you're talking about, I'm going to try to do this, and then I need to talk about it. I need to be able to share what my experience was so I can get better. So this is a patient process, but it's one that ends up producing. What we've just released, it's out on our website if you're interested, and I won't show you the slide because I'm going to wrap now. And I will be happy to stick around if anybody would like to have a conversation. What we've just demonstrated is that in our intervention schools in Washington, we can actually change the pass percent rate on standardized tests by using these ideas against match group comparison schools. And we can, right now, our data is saying we can do it in a year. Now, this is the first study that I'm aware of that's been done with this. So I'm not holding on to that really strong. And until I can show it again two or three times, I'm not going to take it to the bank. But what I did is I took our 10 schools, and in three separate groups, I identified 10 other match schools in each of the groups. So we were comparing against about 30 other schools. Total was, this was based on the experience, about 14,000 kids. And what we showed was an average 12% increase in English language pass rates on our standardized state tests in a one-year process, and the other schools either dropped or stayed flat. So it's encouraging. We're in a place as we're trying to take these ideas that we're kind of building the airplane on the way. And that makes it a little frustrating because we're going to be years before we have kind of the confirmed knowledge about what works here. The challenge for all of us, is the term I used before, is can you unring the bell? If you've once heard these issues and you've started thinking about this, what is the responsibility each of us has as an individual to think about how do we use this information to be better as who we are, and to be better on behalf of other people. Really appreciate you being here this afternoon. I hope this was helpful to you.
This is KSKA, and you've been listening to a program recorded at the Lusac Library on November 3rd about creating trauma-informed communities. Our speaker today was Dr. Christopher Blodgett of Washington State University. I'm your host and producer, Eric Bork, and you can find an extended version of this presentation on our website at alaskapublic.org.